having me today. So I'm a photographer, filmmaker, radio broadcaster. I've pretty much done everything in journalism that you can do. Originally, I'm from Vancouver, and I've spent about 10 to 12 years in Afghanistan, and I've always kind of come back to London as a base. And about 4 or 5 years ago, I set up a production company called Tiger Nest Films, and I work with my colleague Clementine Malpass, and what we have done is try to focus on films that straddle both the broadcast world and the humanitarian NGO world. So almost all of our films are very character driven. And for us, we feel like in the world that we're in today, we really need to, in order to connect with the story of an issue, you need to connect with the issue of a person and one person's journey of what they're trying to do. The other aspect of our work is always trying to look at the gray that exists between the black and white that the media report. In Afghanistan, when I first went there in 2004, I went to set up a radio station for women in northern Afghanistan. And I was so shocked. I'd never been to a Muslim country before. So it was, for me to come from Vancouver to go to Afghanistan, I was completely blown away by the situation of how men and women interacted with each other, but also how the media reported what Afghanistan was like. Because the Afghanistan that I was looking at was not the Afghanistan I was reading in the headlines. And you'll see in one of the films I'll show today about gender issues in Afghanistan and how complex they are. And I think one of the themes of our work is always looking at the gray that exists, because nothing in life is black and white. And I think the more you kind of scratch away at the gray of an issue, you'll be able to make really interesting stories. You yourself will become surprised with what you find, and therefore it makes you a more interesting journalist. I was looking for some clips that I wanted to show, but they've taken them offline, and I'm not sure why. There is a film that I did 2 years ago about Mullah Omar. Do you all know who Mullah Omar is? Or was? No? Mullah Omar was the leader of the Taliban in Afghanistan, and he was basically enemy number one to America. How many Americans do we have here? Okay, so you may have heard the war in Afghanistan, you were trying to capture Mullah Omar and Osama bin Laden. And Mullah Omar he had been thought of as a monster. And a journalist friend of mine came to me and she said, you know, she's Dutch. She said, I feel the way that the media is covering this war right now is negligent. And I'm not going to embed. When I just came in earlier, they were talking about the way that you report on war and if you are, objective or if you sanitize war. And she said, this war has been so sanitized. I need to go and I need to see this war from my own eyes without any kind of military assistance. And everyone thought she was crazy. She's 6'2" and blonde. And she said, I am going to write a book about Mullah Omar and I am going to tell the real story of Afghanistan and what's going on. And she went straight into the heartland of Afghanistan and she became friends with all of these mullahs and leaders and Taliban. And she came back with incredible reporting. And she came to me and she said, now let's make a film about this, of finding Mullah Omar. I said, are you insane? Like, there's no way I'm going to go into Afghanistan's heartland and, all the Taliban, they want to kill you. You're a woman. It's horrible. She's like, no, please, let's just do it. It will be great. And then the French Arte broadcaster commissioned the story, which then even scared me more because I thought, oh, God, if they're, commissioning it, we actually have to do it. And we went in and we had an incredible experience. One of my best experiences in Afghanistan, because we went into areas that no other foreigners had been, no other women had been, and we spoke to people who really knew Mullah Omar. We met his doctor. We went to his house where he had been raised. We went to the first mosque that he taught at. And we started to reveal these layers about him that were fiction. some truths, obviously, but by and large, it was an incredible, eye-opening, revealing experience for me. I had been in the country for 9 years, and I had never thought about a person like that. And I always think of this story as a very good example of why, if you want to be a journalist, traveling to areas of the world that people can't get to, it's so important to take that extra step and research and investigate in a way that other people aren't. Because the other thing I've noticed a lot about Afghanistan was that people like to report on things with the headline already written. They already know what they're saying going in there, and they don't have an open mind about what they're going to find, which then it's a disservice to reporting and to the audience that you're serving as well. So I'm going to, okay, first of all, I'm wondering if what I was going to do was going to show one short film and then have a discussion about it, and then show another one and then have a discussion after too, because they're very different films. But the first film I think I'll show is about Lebanon. And so this is a film about the refugee crisis, but it's about the refugee crisis in a way that most people hadn't really looked at it, because in the past year, since the swathes of people have migrated across into Europe, trying to come into Europe, there is still over 1.2 million people living in Lebanon. You know, one in every four Lebanese is a refugee. And a lot of people didn't want to come to Europe. They don't want to make that journey. And so I'm going to show you this short film. It's about 8 minutes. And it shows, in my mind, it kind of shows the potential of how you can tell stories that also build connection to a human. So it's human connection rather than a story that's about an issue. Because I think, you know, everybody, it's so hard to sometimes connect to something that's going on around the world where you don't know who these people are, you don't know what they're struggling with. And when you are able to just kind of dive in and then do kind of a case study of a couple of people, then I think it's really beneficial for helping people understand what's going on.
More than 1 million Syrians have fled to Lebanon since the war in Syria started.
Okay, 1 sec. How do I make it full screen? Is there a... Ah, great.
More than 1 million Syrians have fled to Lebanon since the war in Syria started. I spent the last 3 years photographing refugees who are living here with severe injuries and medical conditions. It's been a year since my last visit. Now I've come back to see how the families I photographed are coping.
First met Aya a couple of years ago. Aya was born with spina bifida, so she's never been able to walk. She needed medical care her whole life. In that situation, then was desperate. They were very worried about whether Aya would survive.
When I first met the family, they were living in a tent on waste ground. They had left Syria in search of medical care for Aya. Now they've moved from the tent into a half-built house on the outskirts of Tripoli.
Good to see you.
She's grown so much.
I brought them the photo that I took in
2014.
Their living conditions have marginally improved, but Aya's health remains fragile. Her spina bifida has caused an open wound on her back that is at constant risk of infection. Her parents, Eamon and Sheehan, like the vast majority of Syrian refugees here, can't work. They receive $175 a month from the UN, but it's still a struggle to provide even the basics for their family, let alone cover the costs of specialist medical care for their daughter.
أنا بدي أسافر مشان بنتي، مشان آية، علاج آية بنتي بالمشفى آية، شوفها بالمشفى آية ما فيها شيء، لبسها روبة تضل نظيف، ما علي لا دم ولا شيء، هذا طلبي، ما بدي غير أشياء.
But with no work and no money, for now they're trapped in Lebanon.
أنا بعد كذا جناح التهريب، لأني مع 2,000-4,000 دولار.
They've been identified for resettlement in France. They're waiting for a date. Since the war started, fewer than 20,000 Syrian refugees have been resettled from Lebanon. As they wait for the call, Aya's health is getting worse. Just as many who want to remain close to Syria.
Just fix the sheets here.
Lebanon's infrastructure is critically overstretched. The Syrian war has pushed more than 1 million refugees into this tiny country, increasing its population by a quarter.
In the last year, the stories of people in countries such as Lebanon have been ignored. And yet, really, that is where the crisis is. It's where many of the most vulnerable are largely being forgotten. And if we don't support the refugees here, what options do they have?
So, one was to see a family that I met 2 years ago. It's actually one of the saddest stories I saw that visit, a young mother who'd been paralyzed from the neck down. I've returned to the camp they are living in, which is funded by private donations from the Gulf states. I was hoping things had improved. But I found Khalud and her husband Jamal in the same tent with their 4 young children.
I'll be honest, I didn't expect to find you still living here. It makes me sad that the situation is the same.
Khalud was shot by a sniper while collecting food. She's paralyzed from the neck down. Since arriving in Lebanon, she hasn't left this tent.
يعني ما امشي وشوف الآلة عندي وشو ايد امشي معهم وام عم تسحب اولادها يعني كيف معناتها انا بدي احترق قلبي اما انا ولا انا ما عندي سايدة شيء كل النهار هيك كل النهار والليل
بس اهمنا الواحد بهالدنيا انه ترجع تضبط سوريا بكي على سوريا اكثر ما ابكي على حالي
Here, Khalud does not receive enough specialized medical support. Instead, she relies on her family. I showed them the photo I took of them 2 years ago. You know, whenever I look at this photograph, I always see a relationship between the two of you.
اي انا بحبه كثير
هاي في قلبي هون هاي حطها هون حلوه الصوره
As a photographer, in many ways you feel powerless. I can only tell you what I see. I can only be a witness to what I see. I've seen some of the greatest humanity, some of the best in humanity, in those refugee camps.
Shortly after filming this, we heard that Aya and her family were selected to start a new life in France. They hope to leave in early June.
So, that was the story of Giles Dooley, who was a photographer who was blown up in Afghanistan. And
is that known?
He was blown up in Afghanistan 5 years ago, and he was working as a photographer then, and he took about a 3 year break, 2.5 year break after his explosion, and is now back at work. And I worked with him three times in the past year, and it's a really incredible experience to work with Giles because he's gone through so much, and so his approach to storytelling is so gentle, and he really draws people's kind of innermost kind of feelings out when he talks to them, and he's very genuine. And in the middle section of that film, when he's taking the portrait from the camp with the backdrop up, he said, listen, I'm not going to take a picture for at least 4 hours. I'm going to be the most boring person in this camp, which obviously he's not. He's making jokes the whole time. But he, you know, has a presence. He sits. He waits. He's not there just trying to, you know, take pictures all the time. And by the end of the day, we had a lineup of old Syrian women wanting him to take their photo. And it was just really, it's such a different experience, a different approach to storytelling. So I think maybe if you would like to ask any questions about the film or any ideas, but I've done a lot of refugee films in the past 2 years. So if you have any questions about this film or anything to do with refugees, maybe we can open that up now. Or not.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know like too much information about like how the refugee camps work and everything. How are they able to gain access to these camps and meet these people without any restrictions?
That's a good question because it's about so this film went out on Channel 4, but it was a co-production between UNHCR, which is the refugee agency, UN refugee agency, and Channel 4. And Giles had actually met both of these families when he'd been in Lebanon 2.5 years ago, and he was working with Handicapped International. So, because Giles has no legs, only one arm, so they used him a lot as an ambassador to kind of reach out to other people who were suffering, to learn about how, you know, kind of an inspiration. He had access through them. But what was quite interesting was when we were filming, he knew Aya, the family of Aya, and he knew how, you know, he knew where to find them. But one of the things that really troubled him was that he felt he didn't actually know what had happened to the police. And he felt that he had really let the family down because he hadn't really continued with the story, like he hadn't carried on checking in like he had with Aya. So he said, you know, it was the second to last day we were there, and we had a phone call from Handicapped International and said, Khalid is still in the tent. And Giles said, there's no way that, how can she still be in the tent? Like, how is this happening? Like, how could she have fallen through the cracks? And so he was really beating himself up a lot as we went out there because he really felt like, you know, as a storyteller, I have a certain responsibility to do as much as I can, and if they've given me their story, then I should try to I've done everything I can for them. So then about a month after this, then we took Angelina Jolie to meet her as well. And then she had no idea who she was. And then Angelina was really impacted by it, and she worked with an HDR. And so, but to answer your question, you always need to have an access point for now. Because the council really controlled. It's really hard to tell. Any other thoughts or questions?
You can do a lot of photo stories, and so what Giles did to continue the story of Aya was they moved to France. They moved to a little village called, or a smallish town, I think it's called Laval, just 2 hours from Paris, and he went with them, and he then documented photographs as they arrived and what the life like for them to figure out how to eat bread, and collected all the information of, you know, of the transition, so documenting the transition as well. So, because he writes and he takes photos, but I think you can use photography in a powerful way over a long term, because you can use it to document change and see different, you know, emotion is so easy to pick up in a photograph, you know. And when he went back to France with the family, he said he'd never seen them so happy. They were completely, you know, they were in seventh heaven, because they have freedom, and is able to go to the hospital. But he said there was a very funny story about them on the way there, because none of them had ever been on a plane before. And so when they flew to Lebanon, everybody was really scared of the flight, except Aya. She put on her seatbelt and was like, "Let's go!" But she was really excited, and the mother packing to prepare to go to France. They had no idea about that. She's like, "I better pack all of my rice. I don't know if they're going to have any kind of spices." And like, sometimes those little details get so much, like, it reveals so much about people and their fears and what's similar to us, you know? Like, when I come to England, I even bring new stuff from Canada.
I was wondering if the photographers that work here, they have, if there's a lot of emphasis on just knowing the context and the culture of the people before, like, going in and doing the work. Like, is there a lot of training, like, pre-training involved? Like,
you mean for, like, a photographer who goes into a humanitarian war zone area?
I mean, like, a lot of training regarding the importance of knowing the context and the culture and not being to, not trying to infringe upon people's, and not trying to violate the ethical aspects.
Yeah, right, the cultural
norm.
Yeah, I think, well, I'm not sure actually how much training is given to people on cultural angles and practices when you are somewhere like this, and then they study photojournalism. When I studied photojournalism, it was very, you know, this is how you frame breaking news, this is how you go out and do a reportage, this is how you do a photo story. But it's not until you get into that country that you really learn, and I think a lot of it now is much easier because you have so much information on the internet. But there's a project I'm working on right now, and it's I've been doing so much stuff filming photographers in the past year, and this is a project that is filming a photographer who has been making a project on the space that exists in the homes in Germany, Sweden, and Austria that refugees and locals are sharing. And so he said he was inspired to make this project because he had decided to host a family of refugees. And so he has said, "Okay, that's great, they'll come and live with me for a few days before they find a house," brought them into the house, and then he hadn't even thought about some of the cultural constraints, like in Afghanistan and also in Syria,
you wear slippers into the bathroom. But he didn't have any slippers that were there for them to use in the bathroom, and so they were carrying their shoes from the front door to the bathroom, and then there was water overflowing everywhere, and he was thinking, like, God, I just didn't think about that. Like, it's just, everyone lives their lives slightly differently, or like, you know, like, so I was thinking of what else, what are the other things that are going on in these homes that people don't know about, like in the kitchens and weird things. Like in Afghanistan, sometimes I go and stay with this, stay in a local village once a year for the charity I work with that builds schools. And for 4 years we've been there, they don't have any electricity. Last year we went, electricity had finally come to the village. So we're like, oh, okay, that's great for them. They have electricity. So we always sleep in a local home. And so we go in to kind of get our bed ready. And they have a new fridge and the lights. And we're like, well, we're going to bed now. They're like, okay. I said, oh, can we turn the lights out? And they're like, no. Why would we turn the lights out? We've got power. I'm like, yeah, but like, you've got the buzzing of the fridge, you've got the lights. And they're like, this is amazing. Like, really, like, for them, it's a totally different way of interacting with it. So I think you can do as much reading as possible. You'll always find when you get on the ground, there's like, you know, you'll quickly learn when you hear the same thing.
First of all, I'm really touched with the video you just showed us. And I have a question. We see how much of efforts you have put in for this video. You have put in so much efforts going down to Syria, staying there and making this video. And suddenly showcase on Channel 4, as I said. So, what's the impact rate that it's actually made that may help the families or may help other families through this video?
How will they be helped?
Yeah, I mean, like, what's the impact rate, like, on the people who might help them or?
Well, I think for UNHCR, because, you know, their mandate right now is to raise awareness and try and humanize the refugee crisis that is happening. And I think after the film was aired, there was so much reaction, especially from people who were really anti-immigration and anti-refugee. People who said, you know, I've been always wanting, I don't want any refugees to come here, keep them out. Like, but after I met Aya, I was like, I want to help her. Like, I want to help her, and why can't we get Khulud to come? And just, like, Khulud said, I don't want to come to Europe. It's not my desire to become European. I want to stay in my culture, Syria. She said, maybe a country could give me a small tent and I could sleep on the ground of their hospital to see if I would be able to feel again, because I really want to touch my daughter's face and feel her hair. And, you know, these kinds of things were very small. Like, the only assistance that she would need is to be able to come to a proper hospital where she could get properly looked at and see an assessment. And so from this video, then this slowly will happen. But also, people start thinking, who are the other clues and ayahs that are in these camps? Who are the other people who are falling through the cracks? And how, maybe if we give the money to UNHCR, that will help to assist with, you know, helping them out. But it's really difficult because you can't, you know, you raise the story of one person and that's going to change their life. But, you know, what about everybody else? And maybe it won't change their life. The next film I'll show you, you'll see what happens when the whole entire world looks at a story and then still nothing changes. So maybe we'll watch that now. If there are any other questions about this film?
Like hundreds of other Afghan women, she was a victim of rape who found herself jailed for adultery. Her imprisonment in 2010 caused an international outcry, and she became the poster woman for Afghanistan's struggle over women's rights. But in a country where there's not even a word for rape, Gulnaz was soon forgotten. Filmmakers Clementine Malpas and Leslie Knott have followed her story over the past 3 years. Now they've been back to Afghanistan to find her life has taken an even more shocking turn, as Kanye Morris now reports.
Summer is coming in Kabul. The whole city is on tenterhooks In less than a year's time, the multinational forces will leave the country. On the surface, it looks peaceful enough. There are women on the street, girls enjoying their childhood, even a day out at the zoo, no longer wrestling with the moral control of the Taliban. But the story of one 21-year-old woman is a parable for the West's failures on women's rights and a warning of what's to come. Gulnaz was once, for a moment, a symbolic figure for Afghan women. Her 15 minutes of fame began 3 years ago when she was violently raped by her cousin's husband in the family home. It was an opportunist attack. The rapist waited until Gulnaz was alone. It's very rare to hear an Afghan woman speak so candidly about something so private. Gulnaz realized she was pregnant and went to the police. But instead of getting help, she was arrested and imprisoned for adultery. She spent 18 months in jail. Her daughter Muskan was born there. Her case caused international outcry. Gulnaz became a poster girl for the oppressed women of Afghanistan. Everyone wanted a piece of her. Even the president was forced to intervene.
It has to be resolved and resolved by giving her a pardon immediately.
It is brave for a woman to come out and tell her story in the way that Gulnaz did. In some parts of the country, in some families, a woman being raped is seen as having brought such shame on the family that the remedy for that is for her to be killed.
That was Gulnaz speaking 2 years ago. But time passed, and with it, little by little, her resolve was crushed. For all the lip service and presidential pardons, she was rewarded with a shared room for herself and her baby in a women's refuge. Even here, she needed a male relative's permission to leave.
For goodness, I asked her once, I said that, goodness, what does you want? And she was the bluff, and she said that, I want to be free like you. I want to like go to a home and come back. I want to have my own house.
Gulnaz hated being in the refuge. It wasn't the freedom she dreamt of. And that's why, the next time our team met her, in April this year, she'd left the shelter and become a wife to the man who'd raped her. Meet Asadullah and Gulnaz, the unlikeliest Mr. and Mrs. in the world. There's a glacial atmosphere, melted only by the presence of 2.5-year-old Muskan, the product of that rape.
یک زرک ما از زجا مخصد که یک رفتی میدون زکر این دوام هم هیچ بیشی نیست جده هیچ کسی به حساب نبود که یه بردارم
The family dynamics are intriguing.
Tu când ești oameni de bulă de cu? Ce? Bulă de cu?
Little Muskan adores her daddy, her Hada, and he seems to use this adoration to belittle her mother. Asadullah does express a sense of remorse. He may have regrets, but he doesn't admit to raping Gulnaz, even though he was convicted of that crime. For Gulnaz, forced sex has led inexorably to forced marriage. Asadullah is clearly in charge. Normally, lunch is busier with his first wife and five other children. He didn't allow us to film them. He's still sitting next to Gulnaz when we ask her, after 2 months marriage, does Asadullah ever get angry? On the contrary, Asadullah sees himself as the wounded party, newly burdened by the responsibility of another wife and a new child. The moral of this parable? In Afghanistan, men rule and women suffer. In the moment when what happened to women mattered, everyone cared, and everyone donated money, is over. Now, when the threat is very real, no one seems prepared to fight. With the Taliban at the negotiating table, everyone knows, although few will say, that any advances for women could be bargained away.
The big red line that people keep talking about is people say the Constitution, but I think what they really mean is the article of the Constitution that says that men and women are equal. And this is something that it's unthinkable that the Taliban would accept that. I think Karzai wants to avoid this discussion, wants to avoid this argument about how fundamentally committed to women's rights is Afghanistan going to be now and in the future.
It's Muskan's future that's at stake. The brief moment when everyone cared about her mother's future is already a bitter memory. Her loss, not only Afghanistan's loss, but a heartbreaking failure for us all. Gulnaz might have hopes for her daughter, but she's none left for herself.
That's quite depressing. She also then, since then, she has two more children with him. And she still believes as the second wife. With her three children and the other five children. It's like quite a heavy story. It's like quite an unbelievable story because we just can't imagine that after so much money has been put into Afghanistan, and yet this story has so much publicity and so many international agencies covering it. Like you said, sometimes you can't even, you know, there's no way to really help. And you have to really understand the cultural context in which you're working in. And, you know, we filmed for 5 years and we fought against trying to find ways, how can we get Gulnaz out of the country, how can we bring her to Canada or to Norway. But she herself didn't want to do that. She didn't have the capacity to be able to say, I want to save myself. Because in her, you know, she had never been to school. And we take it for granted so much of where we come from. So when we go to these countries, we think, well, you know, I went to school, I've had freedom of movement, I've had freedom of space and time, and I can have ambition and I can do what I want. But for so many women in Afghanistan, they've never even had they've never been asked, what do you think? I think that's a really hard thing for us, especially women, to think about. And then how do you make change in an environment like that? Is it the man that holds the key to changing the mindset? And it's very complex.